Welcome to the Travel Like a Boss podcast, where we interview location-independent entrepreneurs that travel the world like a boss by being their own boss. Here's your host, Johnny FD.
Hey, bosses. It's been a while, but I wanted to do a little catch-up with everybody to let you know what's going on in my life and also to share this Q&A that a bunch of people asked me questions about my living in Kyiv. Do I plan on being a digital nomad again and working online? If I want to move back to Thailand and all that good stuff. So first off, I am still in Ukraine. It's the end of June now, so it's basically summer 2023. I was kind of hoping that the war would be over by now, and now I'm hoping it'll end by the end of the year, maybe for Christmas or New Year's, so I can fly to Thailand directly instead of having to take a train, then a bus, then another train and another bus to Warsaw or Krakow or a neighboring country, and flying through Dubai and then flying, eventually to Bangkok. It's just a lot of work, and that's actually why I haven't been traveling as much. Also why I haven't been meeting up and going on kind of digital nomad related events that I've been invited to and our friends at. To be honest, I'm not in the mood to talk about online business or work since this war started. I was already kind of shying away from it because I wanted to take a break after 8 years of working online and literally having, you know, every single conversation, every single podcast I listened to, every podcast I did, but also, like, if you checked my YouTube history, everything was about online business. I was so focused on making money online, growing my existing businesses, optimizing, starting new ones, and then investing that money. It just was my entire life for 8 years, and I'm glad I did it. I literally became a millionaire because I was so invested mentally and emotionally in business. But after I made enough money, I realized, okay, what's next? Do I work my ass off to make another million? How would it change my life? I still wouldn't be rich enough to be able to just, spend it frivolously and, rent yachts or stay in the Ritz-Carlton all the time and, buy a Ferrari. You would need at least, actually, probably $15 or $20 million to be able to live like that sometimes. And if you want to do it sustainably for the rest of your life, you either need to have continued income at a pretty high level, or you need $30, $40, $50+ million. And I know that $10 million doesn't change much because I have a friend who has $10 million and he still has to stress about, spending money frivolously like that. So I know for sure having $1 million or $2 million doesn't make any difference. But at the same time, it's also a complete dream to be able to have that money invested, to be able to buy a house and not have to pay rent anymore, to be able to help my parents, to be able to set up a retirement fund where I know that I'll have at least enough to live, frugally for the rest of my life. And by that, I mean, using like the 4% rule, which I've talked about on my blog and also the Invest Like a Boss podcast, I'd be able to go the rest of my life and live off of $3,000 a month just from interest and dividends. And in some countries, like in Thailand or in Ukraine, that goes very far away, and actually I can enjoy a good life. So I had decided in 2020, actually 6 months before COVID, that I was going to not work as much anymore. I was going to sell my business and kind of chill out and enjoy life. And I'm glad I did, because when COVID happened, a lot of businesses kind of failed and went down the hill. And ironically, I was in a really good position after COVID to be able to start everything back up again if I had wanted to. Out of all the digital nomad conferences I had started after me, usually, the Nomad Summit had the best reputation, was the kind of most fun conference. And it was like, it was the first one in Thailand. It was one of the first ones worldwide that wasn't super expensive or kind of private like small mastermind based. The only one that I knew that had started before me was the Dynamite Circle, the DC, but that was a paid private group. The Nomad Summit was the first public digital nomad conference that anybody can just buy a ticket to attend. And tickets were never expensive. I think the most expensive ticket for like a general ticket was less than $200. And that included food. That included like, you know, basically like 3 days of activities. And so even then it wasn't expensive. And just people liked it. You know, I'm sure there was, you know, two or three people that didn't enjoy it, but you know, out of the thousands of people who went, in general, people really loved it, you know, and we would do anonymous exit surveys after and ask people how they liked it. You know, the food was always 10 out of 10 because it was literally at a 5-star resort in Thailand. People love the speakers. People love the networking. You know, the only complaints people had were that, you know, they wanted the conference to be longer or they wanted more days of it. They wanted more speakers. But, you know, we just packed in as much as we could. So I know that after COVID, actually, if I started the Nomad Summit again, I would have a huge audience because we have such a good reputation. I can bring people back to Thailand because people have been wanting to travel, but they just kind of don't want to go alone. There's a lot of new remote workers and people who want to be remote workers. I could probably charge $300 or $400 for a ticket and double the ticket price, and people would just happily pay it now because that's just what things cost. But I don't know. I just don't have the desire to spend 3 months planning a big event and going. And honestly, I just wouldn't be as excited anymore. I can, you know, if I was on stage, I would be more melancholy knowing what's happening in Ukraine and how little, you know, our own personal freedom, happiness, you know, ticking off the travel bucket list matters. You know, I was never the type to want to travel to 100 countries just to say I've been to 100 countries. I've never been the type to you know, want to say I've been to every country in the world. You know, travel blogger conferences never excited me. You know, when I heard about the most traveled people conference that some of my friends went to, I'm like I don't think I would enjoy it. I think, you know, the conversations people would had would just be bragging about, oh, have you been to this hard to reach country? You know, it's like, I don't care. For me, I'd rather live in a few places and really get to know the countries well, the people well, the food well, maybe learn a little of the language and really explore it. You know, it took me 8 years to really see most of Thailand, and there's still a few places I haven't seen. Even like Jomtien, this is a new place that, I mean, I always knew Pattaya existed. I just never really went there because it was a bit seedy. And to be honest, in my 20s, I would have loved it, right? Like if I was 21 and you told me there was, you know, this party city that's kind of like Vegas with like, you know, these strip clubs and go-go bars and you can drink buckets of rum for, you know, $5 and get drunk every night, I would have loved it. But it just not been my thing, you know. Like I'll go with friends once in a while to Vegas or to these parties, just to go, because you know, when it's someone's birthday or someone's there for the first time or just I don't know, whatever. But it's just not my, I'm not excited about it anymore, and that's why I never went to Pattaya. I think I went there like one time and I didn't like it, and then never went back in 7 years living in Thailand. But then I discovered Jomtien, actually from a friend of fellow nomad. If you guys have seen his channel, it's Kevin from 30 and a Wake Up. He was a digital nomad I met in Chiang Mai many years ago. And he showed how cheap nice condos are in Jomtien, which is 30 minutes south of Pattaya, but still close enough to go there, to go to the mall if you need to buy something, you know, go shopping, or just to kind of get out of the heat, walk around in AC, to go to the movies, and also to go party, you know, once a month or whenever you feel like going, when you have friends in town, and also to be able to get to Bangkok easily, you know, within a, you know, 2-hour taxi ride, or 1-hour taxi ride, however long it is. So it's really a very convenient place to be, and actually I've decided I'm going to go back next year. So during the coldest, wettest part of the winter, that's kind of the gray, muddy months from probably February, March, April, I'll be there again. I announced it in the Patreon group in Invest Like a Boss, if you guys listen to that, to kind of get a small group together to do more of a, not a co-living, but something kind of a little bit more more official. But I just wanted to mention here, so if anyone's going to be in town, you know, maybe we'll do some meetups and stuff like that as well. So anyways, here is the Q&A from my YouTube channel where people ask me kind of more in-depth questions about what my plans are, if I want to sell my apartment or not, and what life is like here in Kyiv during war. So if you want to watch it and see the video, we can actually see me walking around. Just go to YouTube and look for Johnny FD, and it's the it's a Q&A titled, "Will I Sell My Apartment in Kyiv?" Thanks for following along, guys. Take care. Good morning from the city center of Kyiv. Today we'll be doing a Q&A. I'm going to be answering some of the questions that you've asked on YouTube about what life is like here in Kyiv, but also what my personal adventures are going to be like. So here's number one. Mark Angerman asks, as a well-traveled person, how has your view on the world and life in general changed since the invasion of the country that you now call home? Cheers from Australia. Thank you very much, Mark, for the question. So for anyone who hasn't followed my channel for a long time or hasn't followed me for a long time, I left the US in 2008 and was traveling around the world as kind of a digital nomad, someone who worked online while traveling, but I also took a lot of random jobs and adventures. I worked as a dive master and then a scuba instructor for 4 years. And I also tried my luck at Muay Thai as a professional fighter for a few years. So I've done a lot of different things, and I've been to 50 countries, now probably many more, I stopped counting. And I've seen kind of everywhere. The problem I have now after this Russian invasion is I realize how little things matter when big things matter. When everything's safe, when everyone's in peace, then little things about worrying about, like, you know, what's the coolest beach or where's the best hotspot, those things, you know, are an accurate discussion. But when there's people fighting for freedom, fighting for their lives, and even though it looks like people are just walking around having like a normal life, I'll guarantee you every single person here has known someone who has lost a home or a life, or has someone who is suffering because of the Russian invasion. So when I get invited now on these nomad trips, I still get invited as a speaker at all the big events. I get invited to conferences or just to travel, kind of hang out with people. I don't know, I just can't have the same feeling anymore. And I don't expect every single person, you know, there to suffer along with it, because they don't have this connection to Ukraine. They never lived here. Most of them never been here. Most of them never don't even know any Ukrainian people. So it's not their battle to fight. You know, so if you're from Australia or you're from the US or you're from Canada or something, and you're just living a normal life, you don't have a direct connection to Ukraine. You don't have Ukrainian descent. You know, you're not supporting Russia. You could just live your life and, like, you can really go on. But because I've had this connection of living here and knowing these people, it's hard for me just to enjoy life and just travel as normal until this all ends. That makes sense.
Breaking news. A Russian mercenary chief with thousands of troops ordering an armed rebellion and march on Moscow, only to abruptly call it off. Yevgeny Prigozhin of the Wagner Group saying he halted the march to avoid shedding Russian blood. An extraordinary day of events and chaos. This dramatic video circulating online showing a Russian helicopter narrowly avoiding a missile strike. Black smoke filling the air after a massive explosion at a Russian oil depot. And stunning images of a convoy of tanks and military vehicles making their way toward Moscow. Earlier today, an angry Vladimir Putin vowing to crush the rebellion in a televised address to the nation, calling it treason and a stab in the back.
But at the same time, you know, I do try to have a relatively normal life. At the end of the day, I am a civilian. I'm not a soldier. But I just do what I can to kind of spread the word and volunteer here and there and highlight others. So next comment is from Mike Dang. It says, not a question, but I want to thank you for showing how daily life for civilians are during the war. The coverage of this war has been so detailed due to modern technology and how easy it is to film things. But we often don't see what life looks like for non-military in these times. Yeah, it's crazy. This is the first war ever that everyone has, you know, 4G or 5G. Everyone has a 4K smartphone in their pocket, that there's Starlink, that there's still kind of internet connectivity. So you can literally see drones flying overhead and dropping grenades or dropping water. It's insane that we can actually see it. And if you wanted to, there's, you know, 3D maps that you can watch, so you can see like daily updates of what's going on. And that side is covered. You know, I am not a war journalist. I never intended to be. I just accidentally happened to be here when the war started. So I've been covering that side of it. But my intention is not to be a war journalist. If I wanted this to be the launching point of a career, I'm sure I can do it. But it's just not something I want to go do in the future. I would like this war to end as soon as possible, with Ukrainian victory, of course, and to never think about war or cover war ever again. That is my goal. So I realized, you know what? What I can do is just do what I've always done for the last 7 or 10 years on my YouTube channel, is I can just show what daily life is like. And this is kind of the first time that you'll have a glimpse in what kind of normal daily life is as a civilian in a city that gets bombed every other day.
Guys, I'm just walking out of the bank right now. I'm just looking at defense explosions everywhere.
Ukraine's capital has come under fresh attack. Ukraine-Russian forces have launched some of the heaviest air attacks on the capital.
Russia launching more than 100 missiles and drones on the capital, Kyiv.
He's running for shelter. And I wish that we were able to see this during World War II. Imagine during the, you know, the bombings, carpet bombings of London, you were able to follow a vlogger then. Imagine if that was available. So I think it's really interesting, but also shows how complicated war is. You know, a lot of people have a misunderstanding what a war zone looks like. You know, Kyiv would have looked like Aleppo or like Bakhmut if the soldiers weren't able to keep them out of the city. Sometimes it still does in certain areas when a Russian missile comes through or Iranian Shahed drone comes through. And these are things that I kind of weave in sometimes. And I used to actually just drive over to the place that got bombed. But then I realized, you know what? With my iPhone, I'm not gonna be able to capture a good photo anyways. I might as well cut in a news clip. And then if I just happen to drive by, I'll show what it looks like afterwards. But in general, there are professionals who can show that stuff better than I can. So that's why I'm happy that there are professionals. And again, showing civilian life, 90% of the time, it's us going to restaurants, having a normal life, people walking around during the sun. And then once in a while, something happens where you're like, oh crap, we're still in a war zone. So if you notice, I'm gonna just change locations between each question just to freshen things up a bit so you can see a bit more of the city. But we're on Khreshchatyk now. I'm gonna combine these two questions into one because they're a bit short. One is, Johnny, I'm curious. Miss Winnie says, hey Johnny, I'm curious as what your long-term goals are. Where do you see yourself and what are you doing in 10 years time? And the second is by Kenji Ko. Out of all the countries you visited, where would you see yourself living? And honestly, have you thought about selling your Kyiv apartment since you got back? So I did not even consider selling my Kyiv apartment. I really love it. It's part of, I don't know, it's such a big history for me. Not only is it because it's the first apartment or home I owned, but also it's the first one I've renovated, I designed, I chose all the furniture. I just like, it's like my favorite place in the world to possibly live. And I've actually thought about it. I was like, okay, if I wanted to sell it, where else would I want to live? And there's nowhere else I'd want to live, guys. Like I've really seriously considered it. I thought about Florida, thought about going, you know, even looked in Hawaii, and I was thinking in Thailand.
And I was like, there's nowhere else that would make me as happy as living right here, especially in the center of Kyiv, in this specific apartment itself, that I love it so much and I've designed. I had briefly considered selling the one in Kharkiv, because that was always a rental anyways. Like, I never had that big of a connection to it. And when I had to deal with the destroyed roof from the Russian shrapnel, I was like, you know what, it's just not worth the headache and money of the small amount of, you know, rent I would get from it. So I thought about selling that at a slight loss, but I was like, you know what, I'm just gonna rent it out cheap to volunteers and NGOs right now. So everything's like half price, but at least someone's living in it, someone's using it, so it's going to a good place. But no, I haven't even considered selling my Kyiv place. Obviously things are, the wartime economy is not as strong, but actually real estate in Kyiv itself hasn't dropped by that much. Maybe it's dropped by 20 or 25%, but it hasn't dropped significantly because so many people from other areas has moved into Kyiv. So everyone from, you know, all of kind of East Ukraine, that's now occupied by Russia, but anyone even that lives close to there, they moved here. A lot of people from Kharkiv have moved here. A lot of people from Odessa moved up. A lot of people from Irpin and Bucha have moved into the city because it's safer. So I can actually sell my apartment, you know, now for 75 or 80% of what I bought it for. So financially, actually, it wouldn't be a loss. It would just be, I would never be able to find and buy that place again if I get let go of it. And I just don't want to let go of it. I love it. I want to live there. And that was my plan. So for the next 10 years, my plan is to live in Kyiv half the year and live in Asia or somewhere else kind of warm for the winters. Maybe Thailand, because I love it there. I love the food, I love the culture, I love the people. But that might be flexible. But definitely I would spend the summers in Ukraine, because spring, summer, autumn is amazing here. And I'll probably even spend Christmas here, to be honest. I like it. And maybe 3, 4, 5 months a year, I'll go somewhere warm during kind of the coldest parts of the winter. God, really, look how beautiful Kyiv is during the summer. Like, it really is an amazing place. And I like how there's benches everywhere, people are going to sit and relax, ride bikes, go for walks. I knew this question was going to come up. How is my Ukrainian coming along? And David 80 asks, do you take any face-to-face lessons in the language, or are you just picking it up as you spend more time there? Chesna, zaraz moja ukraińska mowa trochę, which means right now it's not very good, but to be honest, it's really difficult to learn. I think Ukrainian is much harder to learn for me than Russian is. Probably because you just hear Russian more in, like, you know, movies and in music, things like that. And I just didn't hear that much Ukrainian, you know, in cinema or in movies. And even living in Kyiv and Kharkiv before the war, you just didn't hear it that much. So I had to learn this basically from zero. So if any of you want to try to learn a language as an adult from zero, it takes a long time. It takes years. That being said, I am trying because I am living here, and I think it's the polite thing to do. So every day I use two apps. I use Pimsleur, which is actually free for Ukrainian, so you can check that out, which is a very repetitive kind of audio style, but I need that because I'm kind of a slow learner, to be honest. And then I do one lesson of Duolingo a day as well, just to help with kind of like the spelling and reading part of it. And then once a week I meet with someone in person to go over this book that I bought, this like Ukrainian to English. Actually, I just met her yesterday. And then once or twice a week, I like to put myself in a position where nobody speaks English. So I'll either go to like a sauna or something where it's all like old guys who are sitting around speaking in Ukrainian, or, you know, just some other kind of place where I'm like forced to listen to it. I also try to watch movies or like YouTube shows in Ukrainian, but there's not that much in Ukrainian like, compared to in Russian or, you know, in other languages. So it's not been easy, to be honest, but I know the longer I stay here, the more naturally I'll just pick it up by using it every day. And that's actually the problem, is even though I've technically been living in Ukraine for 3 years, before the war especially, I was traveling a lot. So every 2 or 3 months, I would leave, and then I would come back. And as any of you know, when you move somewhere for the first month or two, it takes a while to get into a routine. And that's the main reason why I haven't dedicated and said, okay, every Wednesday at 3 p.m., I'm gonna be going to a class or something. But it is something that I'm working towards. I just know it's gonna be two or three years. So don't expect me to be able to speak, you know, duzi dobre ukrainsky mova tomorrow, because it's gonna be a long, long process. But ideally, I'll be able to just be able to understand a little bit more and speak a little bit more like Shorzhik, which is kind of this like mixture of Russian, Ukrainian, and English, which is honestly what a lot of people speak. It's kind of funny where, especially in Kyiv, like so in Western Ukraine, I'm sure they're just speaking Ukrainian, but in places like Kyiv, in public and at businesses, a lot of people will speak Ukrainian, but amongst friends like that they already know, and they're like, you know what, we know that you're not, you know, some Russian war supporter. They just speak in Russian because it's easier. That's what they've spoken at home for a long time. So at the end of the day, language is not the enemy. The Russian soldiers, Putin, and anybody supporting the invasion, they're the enemy. And before the war, you actually hardly ever heard people speaking Ukrainian on the streets. You know, maybe like 20% of the time. But now it's more than half, I would say. Just like when I hear random conversations. I don't know if you guys can hear, but the couple behind me, they were speaking in Ukrainian. Finally, I can understand the difference now. Like in the beginning, it was kind of hard to know if I just don't understand, or if they were speaking Shorzhik or Russian or Ukrainian. But now, at least I can understand what they're speaking. I just don't understand all the words. You can see this sign is still up. People haven't forgotten. Will I ever go road tripping around Europe now that I have the Beast, the Cayenne GTS? Love your videos, Slav Ukraine from Croatia. You know, it sounds fun to be able to drive all around Europe and then to Croatia with the Cayenne, but I'll never do it, because first, every country in Europe has different road laws, and I have to learn all that. And even, for example, I thought about driving actually to Moldova to visit a friend, because it's technically only 6 hours away, but first to cross the border in a car may take another 8 hours, versus when you're on a train, it always takes exactly 1 hour. So first, while the war is happening, I'm not gonna drive across the border just in case I get stuck for 8 to 12 hours. I just don't want to put myself through that. Second, the Cayenne uses so much gas that it's just not worth it financially. It'll probably cost me $500 just to drive to Europe when I could have just taken a train or flown. And third, you know, if things go wrong, I don't know where to fix it. It's not like a, you know, like a very normal car where you can just go to any shop and get things repaired. You need to find like a specialized Porsche dealership, and it's either gonna cost a lot of money or they're not gonna be able to fix it. So I won't be road tripping with the Cayenne anytime soon, even though it sounds fun in theory, right? It's so windy today that I hope you guys can hear me without issue. I do have a mic on, but it only does so much. All right, so now we are in front of your favorite location, the McDonald's here in Maidan, as well as the metro station. This was actually closed for the first like 8 months of the war, but they reopened a few months ago. And actually, I almost never ride this one, because this is kind of like the central station of New York, where it is very central, and it's only a 10-minute easy walk to my house. But to get from the subway to the street, you gotta walk through so many corridors and up and down escalators. It just takes forever. So I'd rather always take it one extra stop and then walk down the hill. But anyways, here's the next question. Michael Kazier asks, do I ever leave my camera home, or do I make a habit of filming constantly and keeping whatever is interesting? So I used to have this bad habit of just filming random stuff and then trying to make a story out of it, which sometimes is like, it's a hit or miss, where sometimes it's very interesting because you can see snapshots from a lot of different places, lots of different people. But at the same time, it's hard to have a kind of a flowing story. Well, what I learned from hanging out with Baldwin Bankrupt is he only films when he has a story in mind, and he'll he would rather sacrifice good clips from other places than to have to have that mixed up. So when he films, or a lot of successful YouTubers film, first they have a dedicated camera and they say, today I'm filming, I'm gonna have a intro, the story, here's what I'm gonna do, then I'm gonna have a proper outro. It's very consistent, they're wearing the same clothes, the same lighting, the same day. It makes it way easier, and makes it easier to edit as well. So I've been trying to do that more and more now, where I'll have a kind of a consistent flow, because it's easier to tell a story for you to follow, so I think it's more interesting. But second, it's way easier to edit as well, so it just makes more sense. However, that being said, I think what makes my vlog very interesting is being able to show kind of random things that weren't planned. So the reason why I like filming on my iPhone is I always have it with me. You know, they say the photographer's best camera is the one that they have on them at all times. So with video, I can show little, you know, clips in here or there. I'm not always gonna have my mic on me, you know, even though it's not hard to carry. It's just that I'm not gonna plug in this mic if I'm at a restaurant just to be able to like talk to someone for a minute. It just, it is uncomfortable for me, for everyone. It's just kind of weird. But if I just film quickly with my phone, it's a lot more natural, if that makes sense. So yeah, I know sometimes it sacrifices audio quality, but at the same time, it is more natural where you can hear the ambient noise, what's going on. You can capture what life actually looks like and sounds like. But I do try to use a mic and like a tripod if I'm gonna be doing something like a Q&A where I know I'm gonna be talking a lot. I am tempted to go have a McDonald's, but I'm gonna try to fast until 1 p.m. if I can. All right, so this is an interesting question from Andrew, 7445. He asks, when you're involved in that fist fight, were the police called? Was drunk guy ever charged with anything? Have you been in any other physical alterations, and were you had to use your martial arts training? So if you don't remember this, it was in Austria, five, 6 months ago. And I was talking to this couple where the guy was really drunk, and he ended up hitting his wife or his girlfriend. I think it was his girlfriend, and she was like bleeding. It was really bad. That day, I actually asked the bartender or the manager, the owner, the place. I said, "Hey, can you please call the cops? He hit his this woman," and they said, "No, let's not get the police involved. It's okay, it's just a domestic issue," and that's when I decided to get involved. I ended up getting into a fist fight with the guy, and honestly, I kind of regret it because my hands are still fucked up from like 8 months ago. I've lost a lot of my grip strength, and this is from me winning the fight. It just my hand. I broke my fist punching the guy. It could have been much worse. You know, like in a physical street fight, you never would know what's going to happen. You know, you might get knocked out and hit your head, and you might die from it, and you might get brain damage. Or just as bad, you might do that to the other guy, and you might have to go to jail for the rest of your life just for getting to a street fight, even if the other person was at fault, even if the other person started it. So I don't recommend fighting in the streets at all. Ironically, I've never actually gotten into a fight since I started Muay Thai or Jiu Jitsu. Before I ever trained, I actually got into a bunch of fights, never my choice, just that things would happen. Usually friends would get beat up and I would have to like step in, and I had no idea what I was doing back then. But as soon as I learned, people stopped fighting me. And I think it's because they can sense it, that like you know what you're doing and you're trained and you're not scared. So I recommend everyone learn either MMA, Muay Thai, Western boxing, or Jiu-Jitsu. And I'm talking about only these specific four martial arts, because these are the only four that actually has real sparring. Everything else, they either have no real sparring at all, or there's so many rules, like in Taekwondo, where you're not allowed to punch in the face. It just doesn't work in a real fight, because like you can't test you can't test the martial arts if it's all in theory, if it makes sense.
So here's an example of my first ever Muay Thai fight. It was technically a pro fight because there's no shin pads, knees and elbows are allowed. And honestly, even though I lost this fight, I learned so much from it, more than I ever would taking some other kind of martial art, like, you know, and becoming a black belt in like Kung Fu or Krav Maga or karate or something, where you never really compete with all eight limbs. You know, you can't punch in the face or elbow someone. The other person's not actually fighting back. So MMA, boxing, Muay Thai are really the only ways to 100% learn.
This actually makes me kind of think about the U.S. involvement or the NATO involvement in wars, like in here in Ukraine, or even in the past, where even though they were doing the right thing for by stepping in, they end up getting punished for it, and potentially it can really damage, you know, their reputation or their lives. I was in Bosnia earlier last year, and I learned a lot about the, you know, the NATO involvement of stopping the Serbs from basically, you know, genociding the Muslims there, the Bosniaks, and also about Kosovo, where Serbia decided to kill all the people in all the Muslims in Kosovo as well. And it only stopped because NATO got involved and started bombing Serbia and said, look, hey guys, you can't do this, we're gonna get involved. So technically NATO was protecting the people who were getting bullied, but they ended up getting a lot of crap for it. And even today, you know, Serbs will say it's okay that Ukraine's getting attacked because 30, 40 years ago, NATO bombed Serbia. So it's okay that Kyiv is getting bombed today. And it's like, guys, first off, there's no context there. Second, it's a big difference between 40 years ago and now. And then third, like, Serbia was actually committing genocide. So if anything, it would be more closely tied to saying it's okay for NATO to bomb Moscow to stop Russia from invading and attacking Ukraine. And at the end of the day, people will spin things that they want to spin it. And you can't argue with every single idiot online, every single troll. Everything takes a lot more context to explain the backstory of something and how things are different. You know, it's sometimes it's better just to not do it in the first place, so they don't have anything to use against you. So at the end of the day, the US and NATO is going to get a lot of crap for helping Ukraine, even though they are in the right of helping Ukraine defend itself. All right, this is the end of the Q&A. You can see we are here at Maidan now. This is the most kind of famous spot. These flags have grown over the year for people who have fallen from it. And I marked this video as a fundraiser. So if you want to donate to Razom for Ukraine, which is a registered US charity, we are just under $40,000. And if we can get over that after this video, I think it'd be really cool. Quick update. Actually, this is another question someone asked. Is the RCA asks, there's two ways to donate money. One's via YouTube fundraising, and the one's through GoFundMe. Can we get a short update on the usage of this money? Any update on the orphanage would also be nice. So the orphanage in Lviv that we bought some washing machines from, they've actually been getting help now from a charity in Doncaster in the UK. And I'm really glad that someone basically decided to work with them directly. And as far as the two ways to donate, yeah, a lot of people get confused with this. So the official YouTube fundraiser, that only can go to registered charities in the US. So I chose Razom for Ukraine because that was the only one that had any kind of actual presence in Ukraine. Unfortunately, they are a big company. They're a big charity that raises, you know, millions of dollars. So it's really hard to get exact correspondence from them. So Razom being a big charity, it's hard to get contact with them directly, but I've seen, you know, their site and what they're doing. You can follow them I think because they're a registered charity in the U.S., all their books are open, so you can take a look. It would be nice to get some kind of acknowledgement from them, because I've raised now $40,000 from them, and I've never even gotten like a public thank you on a tweet or something. So if you guys want to shout them out, say you know, that you donated through me, that would be appreciated. But what I like about that is I don't have to touch any of that money. I don't have to pay taxes on it or fees on it. That goes directly from YouTube to Razom for Ukraine without any fees at all. YouTube actually covers even the credit card processing fee, and that's why I like them a lot. So the reason why I started the GoFundMe was my buddy Dan had this idea where we can get donations to do like little things here and there, with like be able to just give like cash to the babushka on the train, or to buy groceries for people, buy little things here and there. I never thought it would get so big. And honestly, I didn't want to do it in the beginning because I didn't want to have to worry about taxes. I still haven't paid taxes yet for last year. I need to file that. So I'm a little bit worried I'm going to get hit with all this donation money, because I didn't put any aside for taxes. It's just whatever money comes in, I just try to spend it within a month or so. I do try to keep a small reserve of usually $1,000 or so, just in case something comes up, like this Kherson flooding. That way we have some money to be able to spend, you know, here and there. Or there's a couple families I'm still supporting, so sometimes they message me and say, hey, we really want to buy a food processor, you know, for our baby, like is it possible to help with that? And I'm like, yeah, sure. Or someone needs groceries, they say they have struggling this month. So normally it's just through like a transfer through directly to their bank account. It can be in cash, it can be little things here and there. But if you want to see updates on where that goes, I try to update it every time I do on my Instagram stories. And I even have these kind of pin stories called like Xmas, you know, Christmas Ukraine, or Helping Ukraine. I think there's five stories now completely full, and that's where that money goes. This money though that you give to these random people on the street, probably, I don't know where this goes. So I would rather give to someone I actually know. And those big organizations like Red Cross and stuff, I can never really trust them either. So, yes. Are you really volunteer? Where does this money go?
Huh?
Where does the money go?
Money go. Does this help military hospital?
Okay, and your, how do you send them the money? By card or?
Card.
You send money to their card, or how do you send the money to the military? You giving them the cash, or you giving them by card?
Card. Vitalik,
дай card. Не. No, ничего. So, anyways, these guys selling bracelets. It's hard to know. If you want to donate money to the military hospital, please do it directly. If you want to donate money to the military, you can do that through United 24. That's kind of the easiest way. But thank you guys for watching. If you have any other questions, feel free to leave a comment below. Maybe I'll do another Q&A. But I'm going to leave it with this, guys. What do you want to say to Putin?
Fuck Putin. Putin.
Hello, Slava.
Thank you for listening to the Travel Like a Boss podcast. If you want to hear more, including the bonus How to Choose the Perfect Niche episode, join our mailing list at travellikeabosspodcast.com. See you next week, and remember, if you want to travel like a boss, you need to be your own boss. So start your online business today and start living the lifestyle you've always dreamed of.